for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Conservationists are now using drones and new mapping technology to monitor deforestation, climate change, and illegal poaching. But in the wrong hands, some of these tools could have devastating effects on wildlife. With me to talk about how technology is transforming conservation efforts, Jatna Hoekstra with the World Wildlife Fund, and Andrea Krosta with Wild Leaks and the Elephant Action League. Joining us from a studio in Mountain View, California, Rebecca Moore with Google Earth Outreach. I invite you, as always, to be part of the program. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And welcome to all of you.
Happy to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
John Hoekstra, I'll start with you. Talk about how these new technologies are really transforming conservation efforts.
Technology is changing conservation by giving us seemingly superpowers. We can see more than ever before in more detail than ever before. We can plug people into nature so that they have a way to connect even from a distance. We can go on virtual ride-alongs and gain insights into the lives of otherwise very secretive, elusive animals. And we can also start to enhance the security and protection of nature.
Give me an example of a video ride-along.
Yeah. So it's not a video ride-along so much as a virtual ride-along, but we've using tracking technology, so we can put tags on animals that use GPS locations and follow their movements, and so we can track migrating birds as they undergo their seasonal migrations. We can track elephants as they move across the landscape. We can track jaguars as they hunt their prey through the forests of the Amazon.
How fascinating. And Andrea, tell us about your Wild Leaks website.
Yes, Wild Leaks is the first initiative for wildlife crime and forest crime whistleblowers. It was created, developed, and it's funded by the Elephant Action League, which is the nonprofit organization based in California that I established last year, focused on wildlife crime, combating wildlife crime through collaborative, innovative, and concrete projects. And Wild Leaks is a clear example of this. We basically collect confidential information on wildlife crimes through different means, especially through our platform. And then we try to transform it into actionable items so we can launch our own investigations or with partners. We can share with law enforcement agency, trusted law enforcement agency, or we can share with the media.
And Rebecca, tell us about Google Earth Engine and Google Earth Outreach.
Well, it's been really fantastic that when Google Earth and Google Maps first came out, Diane, in 2005, it turned out that we were putting in the hands of the public the most realistic virtual digital replica of the planet that had ever existed before. We've published more than 20 petabytes of satellite and aerial imagery data. That's 20 billion megabytes. Think about the number of photographs that is, and we're updating this constantly. Huh. When Google Earth first came out, many people said, well, what can I do with it? It's really fun. It's cool. I can fly to my home. I can figure out where to go on vacation. But what's great is that conservation biologists and grassroots environmentalists quickly figured out that it could be a new technology for conservation. And specifically, they're using it, for example, to make fundamental discoveries about the natural world, studying the satellite data that we're publishing every day. So a fringing coral reef previously unknown was discovered off the coast of Western Australia. It was about to be subjected to oil and gas development, but because of that discovery, that was halted. A previously unknown rainforest was discovered on the slopes of Mount Meru, or Mabu, I think it was, and that led to a conservation biology expedition that discovered new species. So discovery and then understanding. People are using, for example, the Sierra Club, and I personally used Google Earth to portray some complex environmental issues and use it to stop logging, to protect the Alaska Wildlife Refuge. I could tell you more about that. And then sort of advocacy. Dr. Jane Goodall tells us that only if people understand will they care, only if they care will they act. Well, these new tools are incredibly immersive environments in which to explain to the public what's going on. And then the Google Earth Engine aspect is now we're turbocharging science so that we've now created almost like a living, breathing dashboard for the planet where you can get in almost near real time a picture of where deforestation is happening, where changes are happening on the planet, and put that information in everyone's hands.
And we have some time-lapse maps from Google Earth's project on our website, drshow.org. One shows the growth of Las Vegas since 1984. The other shows the rapid building of highways, neighborhoods around Raleigh, North Carolina. You can see them both and find more information about creating your own time-lapse maps at drshow.org. John, talk about Eyes on the Forest. This is an environmental effort using these new mapping tools.
Yes, so Eyes on the Forest is a partnership that we've done with Rebecca and her team at Google Earth Outreach. It is a partnership with World Wildlife Fund in Indonesia and a couple of other Indonesian environmental groups. And it uses mapping technology to make visible information about the island of Sumatra, which is one of the only places in the world where you can find elephants, tigers, and orangutans all in the same forest. But they're under threat. We've lost more than 30% of those forests in the last several years. And using the Google Earth technologies, you are able to go and see maps of where the wildlife ranges are, where the forests are, where the national parks are, where the legal palm concessions and logging concessions are. And by making this information available, it's used by local environmentalists. When they see things happening in the landscape, they can see if it's legal or not, and if it's illegal, they can report it. And the visibility, the transparency that we've created by making all of this information available in visual maps has enabled environmental groups to put pressure on major companies that are driving the deforestation there and get them to commit to ensuring that their supply chain of palm oil, for instance, is legal, that it's not grown on illegally cleared forests or forest that's been cleared in a national park.
And so to what extent are they truly cooperating, knowing that they have been seen and caught?
Yeah, well, it's the transparency that puts the pressure on them. So before Eyes on the Forest, we could raise our voices and we could express our outrage that they were doing something we believed to be illegal. But when it's available online and anybody anywhere in the world can see it and validate it, suddenly that voice becomes much stronger. And we've seen companies come around and make strong commitments to get deforestation out of their supply chains, change the way that they source their products in that deflates the market for the illegal products. So it's a very helpful.
And talk about the illegal products produced by poachers, Andrea. Are these technologies really helpful there?
They are. In our case, we built up the WildLeaks platform using a technology called Tor. Tor technology is the only technology available that allow the public to surf the internet anonymously. In other words, if you're using a Tor browser, which works exactly as a normal browser, nobody is able to see the website that you are browsing and if you're uploading or downloading information. In our case, we receive several leaks completed with pictures, with videos,
tips
with files, tips.
From people who are seeing this.
Correct. And some of them are very important. You know, we already started 3 investigations in Eastern Africa, specifically on ivory trafficking, based all of them on 3 separate leaks that we received.
Is that in regard to elephants or rhinos or what?
Exactly. Those 3 leaks in particular are about ivory, but we received leaks about poaching of tigers in Sumatra, for example, or illegal fishing off Alaska, or illegal logging in Malawi. So the leaks cover a variety of topics, of course.
And then what do you do with those leaks?
So whenever we can, we investigate ourselves. So we have our teams, and we work with the very experienced partners. Some of us, including myself, has passed in security and investigation and intelligence, also conservation. So we are merging those two fields, conservation with security and a profession in the intelligence. So we investigate in the field. Whenever it's not possible, we share with the trusted law enforcement agency. We already done it several times. And sometimes we will share with media, and then together we decide maybe to make a story out of it.
But don't the poachers themselves have the same kind of equipment to show them, for example, where the elephants are, where the rhinos are, where the ivory is?
There is a risk. You know, whenever you put a collar on an elephant and then you track this elephant and you track it online, of course, because you have to use, you know, this kind of system, there is always the risk that somebody smart enough will enter the system and will use your data to find the rhino, to find an elephant.
Andrea Krasda, he is the founder of Wild Leaks. He's executive director of Elephant Action League. Short break here, and when we come back, we'll talk further. Take your emails, your phone calls. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking about how new technology is affecting both preservation in terms of forestry and conservation in terms of wildlife. 3 guests are with me. Rebecca Moore is an engineering manager at Google and the founder of Google Earth Outreach. She joins us by Skype. Andrea Krasda is founder of Wild Leaks and executive director of Elephant Action League. And Jonna Hoekstra is chief scientist at the World Wildlife Fund. He's author of The Atlas of Global Conservation and a recent article in Foreign Affairs titled Networking Nature, How Technology is Transforming Conservation. And John, talk about how conservationists in Kenya are using GPS and satellite to protect and monitor elephants.
Sure. It's an exciting application where they've used a GPS collar. They've collared an elephant to be able to track its movements and understand its biology, but they've expanded the application to realize that if they knew where an elephant was moving, they could also use mapping technology to create a virtual fence. And so if the elephant they're tracking comes too close to a village or to a farm and they're worried that it might raid a crop, they can send an alert. The elephant can essentially send in a text message, say, "Hey, I'm getting close to this village." And then the researchers can respond by alerting the village, and the village can take some actions to just deter the elephant and steer it another way. And they found that the elephants will learn. They're very smart animals, so they'll learn to take corridors where they're not going to be harassed. And so they've used this technology both to understand where the elephants are going so they can provide for good corridors for their movement, safe corridors for their movement. But then they've also used it as a tool to help reduce conflict with the local communities.
Andrea, talk about the numbers of the elephants now on the planet as opposed to, say, at the beginning of the 19th century.
Yes, the numbers are unbelievable. At the beginning of the 19th century, we still had an estimate 27 million elephants across Africa. At the beginning of the 20th century, we had only 5 million elephants left in Africa. Right now, we probably have between 300,000 and 400,000 top.
And is it because of the desire for ivory?
It's because of the ivory trade. It's in the 18th century, also, we were also involved because ivory was going also to the United States and Europe. Now the main problem is Asia, in particular China.
China. And what efforts have been made with China to try to halt this use of ivory?
Well, the legal ivory market in China is, in my opinion, the single most important factor behind the elephant poaching. They have an illegal market. And whenever you have a legal market, you create the conditions to have an illegal market, so to launder illegal ivory coming from Africa. And that's the real problem.
Goodness gracious. Have you seen an elephant with its ivory tusks removed?
Several, and it's moving just to think about it, because there are maybe people don't know, but they are among the most intelligent creatures on Earth, and they go through an incredible pain. The poachers now, for example, in some part of Eastern Africa, they don't use rifles anymore because they are noisy, so they use venom. And it's a very, very long, painful death. They walk and for days, and then at the end they collapse. Sometimes rangers have to put them to sleep. So it's really inflicting pain not just to a living creature, but inflicting pain to one of the most intelligent and emotionally charged creature we have on Earth.
And Rebecca, to what extent can Google Earth Outreach help in that regard, not only with deforestation, but with tracking these animals and protecting them from the kind of devastation elephants have undergone?
No, it's a great question, Diane. It's really the work of Earth Outreach of my team is to help foster the use of Google's mapping tools to make the world a better place. And we are working with thousands of nonprofits all over the world now to kind of empower them to protect the planet and understand and conserve. As John mentioned, you can put satellite tracking collars on animals, and you can understand their GPS location in near real time. What we have found some of our partners doing, for example, Save the Elephants, is then getting that live data, overlaying it on Google Earth. They actually have a mission control center in Samburu in Kenya, where they are monitoring against the Google Earth imagery and the 3D topography in this virtual world where the elephants actually are moving. And then they can have almost like a military situational awareness of where the animals are and understand, Are they getting close to an area that's dangerous for poaching? Are they getting close to agricultural fields where they might maraud those crops and then get in trouble? And then based upon seeing that, they then send their rangers out and can redirect where the elephants are. So there's some really innovative applications of how this combination of data about, for example, animal movement in this rich context of this virtual world of Google Earth can empower, you know, much greater protection.
And, John, how expensive is this tracking technology?
Yeah. Right now, on the market, a lot of tracking tags cost an order of $5,000, which is quite a lot, especially when you're thinking about tagging multiple animals in multiple parks. So, fortunately, there's some great innovation going on that's trying to bring the cost down more to $500 or better yet, even $100. So I think as the technology improves and becomes more affordable, it'll become a more useful tool.
So how worried are you about tracking tools getting into the hands of the wrong people?
Yeah, I think, as Andrea said, it's a risk. And I think it's a risk we have to take, but we have to take it in a smart way. So we need that information. It's very valuable information to help us protect the wildlife. I think we need to work with technology partners to understand how can we make that data secure. So how do we impose the same kind of data security that we might expect our banks or our hospitals to have for our financial and medical information? Can we make sure that we have that same state-of-the-art data security in place to protect the information about our wildlife that we value so much?
And what kind of security is there, Andre?
Totally agree. There are a few options. The important thing is to, as he said, start working on these issues with the professional mind. So go to professionals that do this for work, like Google, for example, and ask them to do the job. They know the solutions. And of course, I agree, it's a risk that we have to take. There are very valuable information. But as I also see in other part of my work against the traffickers and poachers, the bad guys are smarter than we think, are constantly ahead of us and ahead of law enforcement agencies. They are faster, they move money, they move ideas, they move people, and they move illicit goods. So don't underestimate these people.
Well, if you don't underestimate them, you maybe eventually catch up with them. But then what do you do when you catch up with them?
Well, that's basically, in a nutshell, what we're trying to do. You know, we have to, after dozens of years of the same approaches, we are trying to be creative and think out of the box and get professionals an idea from different fields and use them against these people.
And now, John, even drones are coming into the picture. Talk about those.
Yeah, so a very exciting development. We're starting to look at the application of drones or small unmanned aerial vehicles to give rangers and park protectors an extra vantage point, to give them some eyes up in the sky where they
can. Where have these been used?
We've been using, World Wildlife Fund has been working with the Nepalese government for the last couple of years already using drones, first to just promote surveillance, just to be able to observe areas. You can get up high. One person, instead of only being able to see what they can see from on foot or from their vehicle, can now get up in the air a few hundred feet, fly for several kilometers, and cover many square kilometers in an hour's time. So it gives them a valuable tool just to surveil and be aware of what's happening, what animals might be around, what people might be around. And I think one of the most promising applications are the night vision that can be applied. You can use infrared cameras. So it gives the potential for rangers to be able to use a drone during the nighttime, and you could potentially see animals through their body heat. You could also see campfires, vehicle signatures, or even people at night. So if you know people shouldn't be there, you can send out a ranger.
But how many people are watching?
How many? Well, probably not enough. One of the big challenges of using technology for conservation is the place where the wildlife lives are oftentimes remote, vast areas with very few people. And so it's a challenge we don't have a lot of eyes right now in those places. Technology can hopefully help us put more eyes in place or be able to see further and see in more detail.
And have you had total cooperation from Nepalese police and Nepalese government officials.
The Nepal government has been outstanding to work with. They're very forward-thinking. They see themselves as innovators. They see the potential for this technology to help them stay one step ahead of the poachers. And in a very, very bright spot, amid all this poaching crisis around the world, Nepal has actually managed to have 2 years with zero poaching, where they lost no elephants, no rhinos, no tigers.
I'm glad to hear that.
The technology has helped them.
All right, let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Ed in Kalamazoo, Michigan. You're on the air.
Yes, well, I had two different questions. One is, can this technology be used to monitor pollution, like, let's say, water pollution, air pollution, point water pollution, by the EPA in the United States, and like we just had a toxic algae bloom in Lake Erie,
right,
which was enormous. And the other question was the polar bear population. Is anybody tracking the polar bear population? Is it going up? Is it going down? Et cetera.
All right. First question to you, Rebecca. Could these technologies be used here in the United States in talking about pollution, water pollution, and the like?
Absolutely. There's a couple ways it could be used. We actually are in a partnership right now with Environmental Defense Fund. Just came out that we've put air quality monitors on our Google Street View cars that are driving around, and we can measure with that methane and soon other particulate matters that affect human health and can create a very detailed picture of the state of pollution in different cities, and then portray that, as I mentioned before, against this this very detailed picture of the planet. One of our goals, I guess I would say, is to try to democratize access to satellite data, to map data, and give all of these organizations the opportunity to present information and tell a story and make a difference.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And then his second question about polar bears. Any information there, John?
Well, some exciting possibilities, actually. So the way that polar bears are monitored today requires teams going out in airplanes, flying over the ice, looking for polar bears in dark, distant, remote, rugged conditions. There's some tests being done right now exploring whether or not DNA technology might help us out and whether we might be able to collect DNA samples from things as innocuous as a polar bear footprint. They might leave fragments of DNA behind that we can collect. The ice is a nice preservative. So if we can catch some of those fragments, we might be able to sequence that DNA and start to identify individual polar bears and get a sense of their numbers. We do know they're declining, but we don't always know how much, and that's a critical piece of information for conservation.
Interesting. Thanks for calling, Ed. Let's go to Zachary in St. Louis, Missouri. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. It's a privilege to be on the show.
Thank you.
I'm calling because I was a UAV operator with the Army, and it's always been disappointing to me to see the public perception of unmanned drone technology as being used primarily for violence. I'm very happy to hear that you guys are using it in the field, but I was curious about whether or not the stigma surrounding drone technology could present a problem as you move forward with peaceful uses for drones.
John.
Hi, Zachary. Great question. And the short answer is yes. We do run into that. People are nervous about the perception of drones being a militarized thing. They're worried about privacy. And so we do have to confront that, and we have to develop kind of socialize people's comfort with these vehicles being used as a positive tool.
All right. To Giancarlo in Miami, Florida, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
My question was about the frequency of updates with Google Maps. I don't know if there's a technology, limit right now or investment or whatnot, but would that help more with, logging? And is there room for private industry there at all?
Rebecca?
Sure. We are continually updating Google Maps. You know, our goal is to have the most accurate, fresh, comprehensive map of the world, and in fact, kind of redefine even what it means to be a map. Some of you may know that we just recently acquired Skybox, which will allow us to make the imagery much more fresh in Google Maps and Google Earth. On the Google Earth Engine side, which is our scientific platform, we're getting feeds from the NASA and U.S. Geological Survey every day of imagery coming in and making that available. It's to scientists to measure in near real time, working with, for example, World Resources Institute, what is happening in the forests right now and issuing alerts. So it's really an exciting time right now. There are, I think, more than 160 satellites planned for launching over the next few years. So this ability to have this living, breathing dashboard of the planet is going to continue to improve.
Rebecca Amor, she's an engineering manager at Google and the founder of Google Earth Outreach. Short break. More of your calls when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Lumosity.com. Personalized brain training developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory and problem-solving through games. Lumosity.com. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, veteran media consultant Neil Oxman takes us inside the world of campaign advertising.
Some of it's science and some of it's poetry.
He'll talk about responding to attack ads and how the flood of money since the Citizens United ruling has changed the business. He'll share some of his favorite ads and talk about being a caddy on the pro golf tour in his spare time. Join us.
And welcome back. We've had several emails like this one from Thomas in Heartland, Michigan, who says, I've always wondered, could the tusks be removed from elephants while they're drugged, thereby eliminating them as a target for killing? Andrea?
No, it's not possible. First of all, elephants need their tusk, first of all, to eat, but also for, you know, to go through forest. So they really need tusks. They are tools, very important tools for them. And then, in any case, it's not practical. It's very complex procedure to sedate an elephant. You know, so it's, no, it's not possible, unfortunately.
So they kill the elephant first.
They kill the elephant first, and then very quickly, because they don't have time, they hack it off and run away.
And what you're saying, Andrea, is that the small-time poachers are not the problem. It's the traffickers.
Exactly. Small-time poachers are, you know, sometimes are just, you know, they just want to make a living, and very often are poor people. And even when they organize, that's the only thing maybe they can do. But the real threat to elephants are big-time traffickers, businessmen, corrupt government officials, corrupt security officers who facilitate the poaching and make money out of it.
And where do you find this most apparent?
Across all Africa. That's the situation, unfortunately.
Across all of Africa.
Yeah.
Here's another email for those who share their data on Google Earth. What does Google do with the data, and do they consider it proprietary to Google once it's uploaded to their platform? Rebecca.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about this because just as anyone can, for example, make their own website and no one on the internet owns, you know, the data you put on your own website, if you create spatial information that you put on Google Earth, Google doesn't own it. We just provide this really rich geographic canvas for you to publish your data. Just as you can publish on a website, you can publish data on Google Earth. But you own the data. We don't own the data. And that's true for Google Maps as well.
And let me repeat for those of you who may have just joined us, at our website, drshow.org, we do have some time-lapse maps from Google Earth's project on our website. One shows the growth of Las Vegas since 1984. The other, the rapid building of highways, neighborhoods around Raleigh, North Carolina. Let's go back to the phones to Christina in St. Louis, Missouri. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I just have a comment, and maybe it can be discussed or at least brought to the attention. Although the elephant is the keystone species, we're responsible for keeping all of the other wildlife sustained in their areas. CITES determined in July to table the discussion of the ivory poaching trade until next year. In addition, the United States, which is the second largest purchaser of ivory, has not enforced the ban that was created in 1989 with a complete ban on ivory, even though there are a few cities with a ban on anything except antique ivory. It's very hard to prove. So to enforce those bans means that we will also cripple terrorism. Terrorism is responsible for, like Al-Shabaab, Al-Qaeda, are the ones who are giving the poachers the ammunition to kill these elephants, and they're recruiting villagers to do so. So by stopping the ivory trade, you're stopping human trafficking, drug trafficking, and that information is available by Born Free USA, who's done a very in-depth report on this. So the only way to stop it is to stop digging from the ground up and to start enforcing the ban, because CITES is not doing it, and the United States could do it right now.
All right, to Andrea.
Well, generally speaking, it's a valid point. I know very well the issue with terrorist organization because I was part of the team who first discovered the link between ivory traffic and the Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab 2 years ago. It is a problem. CITES, I agree with you. CITES could do much more. The United States government is doing something. But, yeah, valid points.
All right. Do you want to add to that, John?
I would just add that, you know, I share your desire to see more done, as much done as is possible, but I think we also are very appreciative of actions that have been taken. For instance, the president issued an executive order directing the U.S. government to start taking stock of how can they help to address the wildlife trade. A commission is put together. The World Wildlife Fund CEO sits on that with a number of other environmental leaders advising. And so I think we're seeing positive steps to recognize that the U.S. plays a significant role to play in helping rein in and break up this trafficking.
But the U.S. has not signed on to the ivory.
They're taking time. There is on the CITES table, there is a thing called it's basically a future mechanism to sell ivory. So it means that there are countries, African countries and some Asian countries that still would like to sell ivory in the future and buy ivory in the future. Right now there's a moratorium that they cannot. So I agree, some countries are still hoping to be able to. And that will be the end of elephants. And so that it's very important to kill, of course, this kind of discussions at the very beginning.
All right. To Vanessa in Key West, Florida, you're on the air.
Bravo, Diane. What a fantastic program. So apropos. And to your guests, John Hoekstra, Andrea Krosta, and Rebecca Moore, bravo for what you're doing. I grew up in Kenya. Nairobi was my hometown. My stepfather, David Allen, grew up the son of Bunny Allen, who was a celebrated hunter back in the 1930s, 1940s. He worked on Magambo, the movie. So at that point, it was considered rather a sort of swashbuckling grand affair to go out and hunt an elephant and so on. Hunting, as you all know, was banned in the 1970s. My stepfather, David Allen, had grown up as a son of his father, a hunter, and made his living. So he then turned his safari business into a photographic safari business, which it remains today. At the time that hunting was banned, the white licensed hunters rued the day because they said, you know, what will happen is we are the police on the ground who keep the poachers out because we've got licenses, we've got a right to be there, and it's controlled. The moment we're out of the way, it's going to be mayhem. Sadly, prediction seems to have come to fruition. What say you?
Yeah, I agree with you, Evisele. At the time, a very slow decline, and then in the last 3-5 years, the decline was really rapid. At the origin of all these, it's a growing consumer market in Asia, especially China, the new middle class. They have more money. They want to show off their wealth, and buying ivory is one of the ways they have to show off their
wealth. And what's being done to try to convince the Chinese to stop.
Diane, if I can comment on Vanessa's point of having people on the ground that are committed to keeping an eye and keeping poachers out is a really vital one. And there are some hopeful signs, I think. There's some amazing accomplishments made by community conservancies in Kenya, in Tanzania, in Namibia, where instead of perhaps the old kind of hunters that may have been around and licensed, now we see the local communities that have been there. They are there. They're going to be there. And they're taking charge of protecting those wildlife resources because of the values that they provide. The key for that to work, there are two keys. One, you need to empower the communities. You need to give them the power and the tools to manage the wildlife on their own. And you need to give them incentives. So you need to make wildlife worth more alive than dead. Mm-hmm. And things like photographic safaris and what can be one of those mechanisms.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. I would add also, you have to protect those communities, the courageous communities, from traffickers. You know, a pair of tusks in Kenya is 4 or 5 years of salary for someone who has no salary. Okay, so every time a trafficker approaches a village like that, he's actually exploiting the whole village.
Rebecca.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on John's point about local communities. We're working, the Google Earth Outreach team is working with indigenous tribes all over the world who are starting to use mobile phones, right, smartphones, as tools for vigilance. For example, the Surui tribe in the Brazilian Amazon has seen a lot of illegal invasion of their land for logging. And they are there on the ground and can literally monitor. They can take photographs and videos, GPS located, with these phones that in near real time go onto a Google map, and they and use that to put pressure on authorities to enforce the law. And they've told us that it's giving them an authority that they never had before.
Interesting. To Thomas in Merrimack, New Hampshire, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. Always great shows. I'm a first-time caller.
Thank you.
I'm just curious, is there a way I can get a clearer view on Google Maps? I've always gone to Google Maps and then on satellite. When I hear of an interesting topic about a certain forest or conservation project, I try to zoom down. I used to be able to do that, like in cities. I could actually make out different things. But today, cloud up that image because of terrorist threats, or should I go to Google Earth? I don't know where I can get a clearer view.
What about that, Rebecca?
Well, I'm not sure I totally understand the question, but the same satellite data is available in Google Maps and Google Earth, and it's always getting better, right? We're always improving the resolution, the freshness, and so on. So if you've ever been able to see it clearly before, it should be at least as good today. Maybe you just don't have as good an internet connection right now.
All right. Good luck to you, Thomas. And finally to you, John, tell us about this new technique that conservationists are using, new software called Invest.
Yeah. So Invest is very exciting software, very high-powered software that World Wildlife Fund has developed in a partnership with Stanford University, the University of Minnesota, and the Nature Conservancy. And it allows you to map and measure and quantify the value of nature. So we have a gut sense that nature is valuable to people in a variety of ways, the aesthetics, the recreational value, but there's also very utilitarian values, water supplies, timber supplies, fish supplies. We know that, but that too often is left out of our thinking as we make decisions about development and how we use natural resources. Invest makes it possible for us to map and quantify, measure and value those resources. And we hope that this is really going to transform the way that we view changes that we make to the world and the trade-offs that we are and are not willing to make with respect to our natural resources and the wildlife that they support.
Now, do I understand that companies like Coca-Cola and major governments are using this?
Yeah, so a very exciting accomplishment. Recently, we worked with the government of Belize. World Wildlife Fund worked with Belize to help them develop a coastal zone management plan. They're a coastal country. They rely on tourism, fishing, and as they think about development, Invest helps them make decisions about where to divest, where to protect, in order to maximize their nature.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Michael in Oklahoma City. You're on the air.
Hello, Diane.
Hi there.
I am such an admirer of yours, but until now I haven't called.
So well, glad to have you.
You do.
Thank you.
And I'm very passionate about the elephant and the other poaching, but I think this is a half measure. I think this is a half of a solution. We're just watching the destruction in this way. If we only monitor and rely on teams of rangers that are forced to roam huge areas, we'll never stop these poachers. And I don't believe that the other solutions that we're talking about should be abandoned, but I think a key piece of this is to recognize that it's an emergency situation. The destruction is exponential at this point. The price of ivory is far too high, and we need to deploy armed drones to stop the poaching. We need to stop the poachers. We need to, unfortunately, kill all the poachers that approach elephant herds and monitor these herds. And I'm very passionate about this.
I can hear that. We're talking about perhaps trying to stop them, perhaps trying to arrest them. Are they also being targeted for killing?
No, of course, no. Our priority is not to kill poachers. As I said, some of them are just, you know, just need money to support maybe a family of 10. So you can also...
But how do you get at the traffickers, which, as you said, are the big problem?
Exactly. The key word here is intelligence. We need more intelligence in the field.
Where is that coming from?
Well, as Elephant Action League and Wild Leagues, we are on the field. We create a network of potential whistleblowers. We run our sources. We do investigation. And then when we have enough, we share it law enforcement. And this is the kind of job that has to be done also, with the help, for example, of the U.S. government. You know, I understand to send to Eastern Africa, you know, put boots on the ground and send weapons and send technology, but also send intelligence experts would help a lot.
And I think it would indeed. I think there are so many people like our last caller who are passionate about these creatures and feel we must do more to save them and conserve the resources of the planet. Thank you all so much for being here. John Hoekstra of World Wildlife Fund, Andrea Crosta, founder of Wild Leaks, executive director of the Elephant Action League, and Rebecca Moore. She's the founder of Google Earth Outreach. Thank you again.
Thanks for listening.
I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yurd-Lifter answers the phones.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Novo Nordisk.